Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Freedom of Species would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional owners of the land on which we broadcast today. We pay our respect to the elders of all of the lands on which we meet across Australia.
Welcome to Freedom of Species on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on your dial. We are the show that brings animal advocacy to the airwaves. You just heard Sally Goldner with Out of the Pan, and Sally's show runs every Sunday from 12 to 1 PM just before Freedom of Species. I'm here in the studio on this hot Melbourne day with Nick.
Hello.
And we are doing part 2/part 3/part 1000 of my series about the Australian wool industry. But first, we got Melbourne Cup Day coming up this Tuesday. So we got a few events to announce.
Yeah, so these are all from nuptothecup.org, and you can just click on events near you to find events all around Australia, but I'll just read the Victorian one. So there's the Melbourne Pup, which is on the 2nd of November. That's 1 PM, organised by Tiny Tails Rescue. The Melbourne Pup is an Up to the Cup event fundraising for Tiny Tails Rescue and donations to Pets of the Homeless, featuring Dogs Day Out, Tiny Dogs Races. No one gets whipped or shot, which is a bonus. There's also the Nup to the Cup protest in Heidelberg. That is on the 4th of November at 10 AM. And that is, yeah, a protest, a Nup to the Cup protest, and yeah, organized by local Nup to the Cuppers Crawley. So yeah, Tuesday, 4th of November, 10 to 11 AM at Burgundy Street. Meet outside Leo's. So again, all the information you can find for these is at nuptothecup.org. And the final one I had was Nup to the Cup Drag Bingo Bottomless Brunch, 4th of November, 12 PM at Evie's Disco Diner, which is just down the road from 3CR. And they're hosting their annual Nup to the Cup Drag Bingo Bottomless Brunch, hosted by Tilly Capulet at Evie's Disco Diner. So that's another one you can check out.
Wow. Nick, we spoke before, we both wrote down three events, and I actually have three different events.
Oh, wow. Okay.
From the ones that you have. So there's so many different events for Nup to the Cup. There is the big protest picnic that happens at Newmarket Reserve near Flemington Racecourse, and that starts at 10 a.m. on Cup Day. So that's probably the one that's like closest to the actual Melbourne Cup Day event. There's also an event happening at Welcome to Thornbury from 12 to 8 p.m. on the same day. And tomorrow, on Monday the 3rd of November, there's actually a Nup to the Cup parade happening starting from 11 a.m. at Flinders Street Station. So there's all kinds of things on if you want to get involved.
Just on a side note, not so much happening for World Vegan Day yesterday, because my parents actually sent me a big event that was happening in Perth on the other side of Australia. And yeah, I did have a quick look about what's going on here, and all I could find for World Vegan Day was an Italian restaurant was doing a vegan theme night. But
wait, when is World Vegan Day? Is that the 10th?
Yesterday.
Oh, it was yesterday. Yeah, oh my first god. Of November. I'm a bad vegan. I didn't even realize.
Well, they used to be the showgrounds things, but I think that is on hold for now.
Happy World Vegan Day to all the vegans out there for yesterday. All right, so do we want to get into today's show?
Are you going to recap part one as well?
Yeah, that's right. So I'll just give a bit of background for people who are coming in cold here. So back in August, I put out a show called Riding on the Sheep's Back, A Vegan's History of the Australian Wool Industry from 1700 to 1806. And that episode covered some of the history leading up to the founding of the Australian wool industry. So today is a continuation of that story, and we're going to be talking about the Australian wool industry of the 1800s. And, you know, I had big plans that I was going to cover the whole century today, but a lot happens in this century. And so it looks like I'm only going to get up to about the 1820s. Yeah, it's a very dense history. So if you want to get the full backstory, I recommend listening to the previous episode about the 1700s, which you can find on our podcast archive. But I will give a recap. So today's show should still make sense as like a standalone piece, but you would be missing out on some context and details. So the reason I wanted to talk about the wool industry is because I think it's very important for us all to understand how animal agriculture has been a tool of geopolitical conquest, not only in Australia, but in many places around the world. When we talk about a colonial frontier, that usually refers to a place where they're trying to extend livestock grazing land, or at least that's definitely what it meant in the 19th century. So last time we set the scene on what was happening in the British Empire leading up to the colonization of Australia and the establishment of the Australian wool industry. A key point here is that wool had already been an extremely important trade commodity in England for several centuries by the time the 1700s roll around. And the monarchs and lords of England had already taken several steps to transform the island of Great Britain into the perfect wool farm. Some of these steps included the eradication of wolves from Great Britain by the 1500s and the Highland clearances, in which the indigenous people of the Scottish Highlands were forcefully removed from their homelands for the expansion of the British wool industry. So they put sheep on the land instead of people. And these events are foreshadowing what would happen later in Australia. So during the 1700s, industrialization and capitalism is really taking off in England, and the British Empire is trying to expand everywhere they can. This includes sending fleets of ships to the colony of New South Wales, which began expanding initially from the lands of the Gadigal people. So they started clearing the lands of the Gadigal, Dharawal and Bidjigal people to plant introduced crops and to graze introduced animals like sheep and cattle. By doing this, they were destroying indigenous food sources. So a common form of indigenous resistance was to burn these crop fields. Land is food, after all, and that's what these fights were over. In the previous show, we had been following the story of Australia's first wool baron, a man named John MacArthur, whose face was depicted on the Australian $2 note until it was discontinued in the 1980s. So this guy used to be considered an Australian hero who set the nation on its path to prosperity. But before even starting the Australian wool industry, MacArthur had done a lot of scheming to advance his position in the colony. Due to the corruption of one acting governor, John MacArthur manages to get himself promoted to paymaster and inspector of public works, which enabled him to become very wealthy from the illegal rum trade. And alcoholic rum actually becomes a de facto currency in the colony of New South Wales for several years. Subsequent governors tried to stop this racketeering, but the officers of the New South Wales Corps are all in on the scheme, and they hold so much power in the colony that even the appointed governors have not been able to stop them so far. So the New South Wales Corps had essentially formed a trade cartel and a military oligarchy. For MacArthur and other officers of the New South Wales Corps, the privileges and status they enjoyed in Australia far exceeded what they had known from their previous lives back in England. Many were of similar social backgrounds to the convicts, but in military-controlled New South Wales, they got to become landowners. Stolen landowners, I might add. Remember, John MacArthur himself was the son of a displaced Scottish Highlander, displaced by the British wool industry, of course. His family previously enjoyed no status and little wealth in English society, but in New South Wales, he was able to become a wealthy land baron or a pastoral capitalist. So of course these officers didn't want this corrupt system to end. They benefited from it. They were getting rich on a generational scale. There are descendants alive in Australia today whose generational wealth can be traced back to these corrupt officers. A previous governor had sent John MacArthur back to England for a court-martial, expecting him to face legal consequences for his actions, which included but were not limited to racketeering and shooting his superior officer in the shoulder during a pistol duel, which was a little bit of a habit of his. However, his list of charges went missing during the journey to England. So instead of facing legal consequences, he quits the New South Wales Corps and schmoozes the right people in England to get himself another 10,000-acre land grant, plus 10 merino sheep from the royal flock, which are extremely valuable in this time period. He then buys his own ship and sails back to New South Wales as a free settler, ready to start the Australian wool industry and become a wealthy aristocrat. So that's where we left the story last time. New South Wales is a very drunk and corrupt place, and John MacArthur is one of the richest men in the colony with effectively more power than even the governor.
Yeah, and I wanted to maybe bring in a few, but I don't want to bring in too much because I know you've got part two to come as well. But I guess one thing that stood out to me was that the whole discussion about rum and politics, and it just reminded me there's a book which I've read a bit of, and this was a book there was a launch, which was a 3CR event. It was called Knocking the Top Off: A People's History of Alcohol in Australia. And it kind of looked at that intersection between alcohol and politics. I'm not sure if that is specifically covered in that book, but yeah, there was lots of interesting stuff, and yeah, it had Gary Foley and many other Jeff Sparrow, many other authors in it, but yeah, quite an extensive collection sort of looking at the connection between alcohol and yeah, politics and working class movements and gender and all different types of things. So that kind of came to mind. Another thing from part one, this was only sort of an offhand comment, but it was quite an interesting one, the idea that World War One may not have happened if not for the Australian wool industry, because there was a lack of synthetic or like plant-based fibres that could have withheld those cold temperatures at the time. And I guess the other thing, I guess this is more just your sort of the focus you're bringing to freedom of species, but yeah, 77% of the world's agricultural land is used for animal agriculture, and yeah, when we're looking at conflicts over land, it definitely highlights animal agriculture as a geopolitical issue. And yeah, I think that's definitely something, a focus you bring to the team, as well as I guess a bit of a different style in terms of like maybe even like, I'm not sure what you call it exactly, but maybe like an audio essay type format, yeah. I guess, which is great as well. And maybe I'll bring in one more point as well, which was, it was interesting kind of hearing about the Second Fleet, because yeah, it's something I haven't really looked into much, but someone in my family has written a family history book. And yeah, my family did come over from Ireland on the Second Fleet. So it was quite interesting hearing about the rate of deaths and how maybe unlikely it was that actually got across here, considering how many people died on that Second Fleet compared to the first, was another interesting point.
Yeah, okay, yeah, so your ancestors were transported like as convicts on the Second Fleet?
No, I don't. Again, I haven't read the book. As far as I know, it was settlers, colonials,
free settlers.
Yeah. The book's there. I just haven't read it.
Yeah, that's really interesting, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just wanted to say, and you know, we're not up to World War One yet. I feel like it's too much to say that it wouldn't have happened without the Australian wool industry, but it may not have been so large scale because they kind of, you know, it enabled it, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get into what happens next. So at this point, where we left the story, it was 1806, and the Rum Corps, which was the nickname given to the New South Wales Corps, is still in charge, and Governor William Bligh has just rolled into New South Wales to try to sort the situation out. Have you heard of William Bligh, I'm wondering?
Name sounds vaguely familiar, but I'm also wondering if that's just because of
maybe because of
there's
me.
A song, yeah, or, yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah, and the song,
yeah, yeah. Yes, yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah,
yeah. So to me, he's one of the more interesting colonizers. So I'm gonna spend a little bit of time explaining who he is. So in the previous part of this series, I mentioned that John MacArthur joined the military at age 15, which was not uncommon for the time. Well, William Bligh was born in 1754, but his Navy service began in 1761. So that means he was 7 years old when he joined the Navy,
Jesus.
Which is kind of crazy. I think he was from a very military family, so start him young.
Jesus.
And I can't help but think that's got to have something to do with like the way he turned out too.
Absolutely.
So William Bligh is a hardened guy on another level. That being said, history has possibly been a little unfair to him. As a young man, Bligh was on some of Captain Cook's expeditions, and when Cook was killed by Hawaiians in 1779, Bligh was the one who had to navigate the ship back to England. So I think Captain Cook was like a bit of a mentor of his or something. So while John MacArthur was long remembered as an Australian hero, only for historians to reassess this later, William Bligh was kind of the opposite. Bligh was remembered and portrayed for a long time as an Australian villain, but was he really? So probably the most famous story involving William Bligh is the mutiny on the Bounty. I could dedicate a whole radio show to explaining that story, but it wouldn't have much to do with animals, so I'll just give a brief overview. In 1789, William Bligh was captain of a ship called the HMS Bounty, which travelled to Tahiti to collect breadfruit plants. Due to the seasonal timing, they ended up staying for a five-month layover in Tahiti, during which many of the English sailors started hooking up with and forming relationships with the local Polynesian women. Navy life was very rough, so this was kind of like a nice tropical vacation for them. Now, Bligh himself remained chaste, but he allowed his crewmen to do their thing while on Tahiti. But of course, eventually they had to leave Tahiti and go back to their rough Navy life, which they were not super happy about. So something to remember about 1700s Navy life is that the punishments they were allowed to administer included floggings and even the death penalty for more severe insubordination. But this was generally at the discretion of the ship's captain, and some were more brutal than others. Before reaching Tahiti, Bligh had rarely punished his crew, and the historic records show that he was generally not a harsh disciplinarian compared to other British ship captains of the time period. However, after their 5 months in Tahiti, Bligh's crew had become slack, so he did start ordering floggings to men who had severely neglected their duties. So the main thing we need to know about Bligh's character from this is that he wasn't especially brutal or sadistic, but he was just kind of a rude asshole. He'd berate his men for mistakes and sometimes humiliate them in front of the rest of the crew or the Tahitians. So that put him in the unfortunate position that some of his men hated him, but they were not scared of him. To quote the National Museum of Australia, Bligh was competent, strong-willed, and determined, but these qualities were not tempered by tact and charm. So to cut a long story short, several members of the crew did a mutiny, and they seized control of the HMS Bounty. They put Bligh and his loyalists in a little jolly boat with a compass, four cutlasses, and 5 days of food to fend for themselves on the open ocean. Apparently, half the crew wasn't keen for the mutiny, so there were more than 20 guys in this little boat that was barely floating above the water level. Now, to briefly wrap this story up, the mutineers took the Bounty back to Tahiti and picked up their new Polynesian lovers to set sail with them to find a new island to live on, because they knew the British Navy would be searching for them on Tahiti to execute them for the mutiny. So they were totally forfeiting their place in English society. They could never go back after doing this. They ended up settling the uninhabited Pitcairn Islands, which is in a very remote part of the Pacific Ocean. They set fire to the HMS Bounty so they wouldn't be discovered. The descendants of the English mutineers and the Tahitians still occupy Pitcairn Island to this day.
Wow.
And I think there's about a population of around 35. Meanwhile, William Bligh, against all odds, navigated over 6,500 kilometres with no map, only a compass, in that small boat to the island of Timor, which was a Dutch colony at the time. Remarkably, almost the entire crew of the jolly boat got back alive, with just one man being killed by natives on Tonga during a stopover. They sailed past many islands, including Fiji, but they didn't risk stopping again because they weren't sure if the indigenous people would kill them, and they only had a few cutlasses, so they were pretty defenseless. So I gotta hand it to him for this. He was an excellent navigator and he got his crew back alive, although some of them succumbed to tropical diseases after landing. Now, there have been no less than three Hollywood films depicting the mutiny on the Bounty, one in the 1930s, one in the 1960s, and one in the 80s. I haven't actually seen any of them, but from what I can tell, William Bligh's character is generally portrayed as an evil villain who was needlessly violent, ruthless, and cruel, while the films were more sympathetic to the mutineers. The historic records, however, show that he tended to be more fair and sparing with dishing out harsh punishments such as floggings and executions, which were commonplace in the Royal Navy at the time. It's easy to villainize Bligh, but the mutineers themselves were definitely not ethical people either. The details of what happened with them came out slowly over time, and let's just say they did not treat the Tahitians as equals, with patriarchy and white supremacy strongly influencing how they ran their society on Pitcairn Island. So I tell this story to show that the first drafts of history are often written with an agenda to smear the reputation of one person to the benefit of others. It's a form of propaganda in a way, and I think John MacArthur was excellent at using this strategy to get himself ahead. All this happens before William Bligh becomes governor of New South Wales in 1806, but what happened to him on the Bounty would foreshadow what happened to him as the governor of New South Wales. So with that background out of the way, let's go on to the first song. Mm-hmm. So I actually found a song about William Bligh, which is kind of funny, from this American punk band, and the band's name references a particular Australian historic event that we are going to talk about in the next section. So this song is called Bligh by the band Rum Rebellion.
Freedom of Species thanks Animal Free Science Advocacy for their financial support of this program. Animal Free Science Advocacy works to create a future where no animals are harmed in the name of science. And scientific progress is advanced through animal-free research methods. Become a member today by visiting animalfreesci.org.au. That's animalfreesci.org.au.
Welcome back to Freedom of Species on 3CR Community Radio. You just heard the song Bligh by Rum Rebellion. A little bit of an anti-Bligh song, which is fine, but I just think he needs to be not the only person in this story who gets villainized. So we have been talking about the early history of the Australian wool industry from a vegan perspective, and we are just up to talking about John MacArthur's greatest enemy, William Bligh, who has just been assigned as governor of New South Wales. So one of the first things Governor Bligh does in Sydney is to use the government stores and herds to provide relief for struggling farmers on the Hawkesbury River. The farmers greatly appreciated this, but the Rum Corps cartel did not, because it impacted their ability to extort people. So pretty quickly, Bligh starts to clash with MacArthur, and given that both these men were known to be extremely hot-tempered, this escalated into a conflict of historical proportions. Bligh halts the illegal importation of spirits and attempts to regulate trade on the trade in the colony. These actions counteracted the power of the wealthiest men in the colony, including MacArthur, while improving the welfare of the poorest settlers. So both these men are colonisers, right? But we can think of William Bligh as a state coloniser. Well, MacArthur was more like a capitalist coloniser. MacArthur was trying to enrich himself and his associates, while Bligh was trying to do what was best for the colony overall. So, you know, if I had to choose Team MacArthur or Team Bligh, I think I'm leaning slightly towards Team Bligh in this case. The commander of the New South Wales Corps at this time is a guy called Major George Johnson, and he is also profiting from the illegal rum trade and is loyal to MacArthur. So to skim over some details here, MacArthur is supposed to appear in court for some things he did. It's a long story. We don't have time to go into it. He's always doing things. But him and the other six officers of the court refused to cooperate with the trial. Bligh informs Johnson that he considered the actions of these officers to be treason. Later that same day, Johnson leads an uprising against the governor. On January 26, 1808, the New South Wales Corps marches to Government House to arrest Governor William Bligh in the only coup d'etat in Australian history, which later came to be known as the Rum Rebellion. So we are now three governors down, and the Rum Corps is still running the colony like a cartel. And now we've actually got a military junta in control, with Johnson as the de facto acting governor. And MacArthur gets to be colonial secretary, which is a position that they just created for him. So MacArthur uses his new unobstructed power to arrest and jail anyone who was not loyal to him, like a dictator. There is also a propaganda campaign against Bligh, depicting him as both tyrannical and cowardly. It seems like their attempts to smear Bligh's reputation were pretty successful for a good 150 years or so. Bligh was shown as a cartoonishly evil villain in the 20th century films about Mutiny on the Bounty, while MacArthur got his face on the Australian $2 note and a lot of things in Australia named after him. So it's a fun story to think of the Rum Rebellion as some uprising against a tyrannical governor, but the truth is it was a bunch of corrupt military oligarchs trying to further enrich themselves at the expense of everyone else. So even though I do think Bligh has been portrayed a little unfairly, I think that it also demonstrates the importance of just being a nice person. So, you know, don't end up like William Bligh, everyone. MacArthur's power would wane after only a few months, though, because the officers of the New South Wales Corps were pretty worried about getting charged for mutiny. The new appointed governor, Lachlan Macquarie, is instructed to arrest the leaders of the Rum Rebellion, John MacArthur and George Johnson. But before he arrives, MacArthur and Johnson leave Sydney on a ship back to England to defend themselves in court. Now, people who listened to part one will remember that this has happened before, that MacArthur was sent to England for a court-martial. And just like last time, he gets away with it. He gets the charges dropped, the charges of overthrowing the appointed governor, due to his friendships with British aristocrats like Lord Camden. But Governor Macquarie still has orders to arrest him back in New South Wales, and unlike Bligh, Macquarie was sent with his own regiment of soldiers to replace the Rum Corps. So MacArthur has basically lost his mob boss status back in New South Wales, and because of this, he doesn't dare return to the colony for the next 8 years. But he definitely uses his time in England to his advantage. This is where John's wife, Elizabeth MacArthur, becomes very important to the story of the Australian wool industry, because she runs the sheep farm while he is away, and she is responsible for exporting the very first bales of wool to England. John then receives the shipment in London and markets them for sale. In the early days, wool could only be grown by wealthy landowners, because they needed to handle every step of the supply chain. Substantial upfront capital was needed to finance a wool growing operation, which was at that point a speculative investment. Wool entrepreneurs such as MacArthur were not only land capitalists and agriculturalists, but also traders and marketers. But you know, they saved a lot of money on farm labor because they had free convict labor. And that's carceral capitalism right there. And that's kind of how Australia really started. You've got theft of Indigenous land, carceral labour, and animal exploitations. And it seems like those are the values that this country was founded on at this point. So to quote a PhD thesis I read from Hendrick 2024, these pioneers managed all aspects of the pastoral capital circuit. So that quote kind of summarizes the point I'm trying to make with this series about the Australian wool industry. The pastoral capital circuit was managed by pioneers. In other words, animal agriculture is capitalism and colonialism. Animal agriculture was the tool which was used by colonizers and capitalists to remove Indigenous peoples from their land, whether it's the Scottish Highlands, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, or South Africa. Is the same mechanism being used, pastoral capitalism. I was thinking we might go up onto the next song next. So this song, I think, kind of fits really well into what we're talking about here. And it's called This Land Is Mine by Kev Carmody, featuring Paul Kelly and Kelson Pell.
Free Freedom of Species would like to thank Project Fresh Start for their financial support of this program. Project Fresh Start provides free plant-based food to the community, with a focus on providing healthy, fresh plant-based food and education around healthy eating and living in a way that sustains the individual, the community, the animals, and the planet. To find out more about our community lunches and programs, check out projectfreshstart.org.au.
Welcome back to 3CR Radical Radio. You're listening to Freedom of Species, and Betty is taking us through the history of the Australian wool industry in the 1800s. So I'll pass it over to Betty, who's going to have a few more points and then perhaps some discussion at the end, I think.
Yeah, so firstly, you just heard the song called This Land Is Mine by Kev Carmody, Paul Kelly and Kelton Pell. So where we left off before, the wool industry had just started as an export trade, and this will set Australia on its path to what it will become. So for this last section, I wanted to talk a little bit about the legacy of Governor Lachlan Macquarie, who was governor from 1810 to 1821, which makes him the longest lasting governor so far. For this section, I want to give a trigger warning because I'm going to talk a little bit about the violence Macquarie ordered against the Dharawal people as he expanded the colony. Like MacArthur, Macquarie was also indigenous to the Scottish Highlands, so he was both colonised and a coloniser. He did make some progressive reforms, such as the emancipation of former convicts. And, you know, MacArthur wasn't very happy about that because from his perspective, if we emancipate the convicts, who's going to be the permanent underclass? You know, he wants to become an aristocrat, and he can't do that if there's not a permanent underclass. A lot of city development happened under Macquarie and expansion of that pastoral capitalism. These animal agriculture operations were expanding into Dharawal country, which led to a series of violent conflicts between settlers and Dharawal people known as the Hawkesbury and Nepean Wars. In April 1816, the first military massacre of Aboriginal people was ordered by Governor Lachlan Macquarie, and this would come to be known as the Appin Massacre. This attack occurred in the middle of the night against unarmed people who were resting. This was a devastating tragedy to the Dharawal people, which they are still recovering from to this day. Not only was it a catastrophic loss of life, but the survivors were displaced and forced to flee to other areas. The actions of the soldiers were praised by Governor Macquarie. The MacArthurs were not directly involved in the massacre, but they certainly benefited from it, as it allowed them to further expand their wool-growing operations into Dharawal country, which was later renamed the MacArthur region, to add insult to injury. This laid the foundation for the rapid expansion of the Australian wool industry that would take place in the 1830s. The bones of these murdered people were sent to Scotland as trophies to be studied in the University of Edinburgh. I was horrified to learn that many human bones, which are currently held in universities, museums, and private collections all around the world, come from murdered Aboriginal people, and communities are still trying to get back the remains of their ancestors so they can finally be laid to rest. I want to give a shout out here to a couple of other podcasts, Frontier War Stories podcast and Doin' Time, which is a 3CR program. They both have episodes about the Appin Massacre, which explained in a bit more detail what happened that night and the aftermath, as well as some more recent activism that has been done to protect the site and to raise awareness about the massacre. So I know that there's been an annual memorial being held in the area to remember the victims of the Appin Massacre. So that's about all the information that I prepared for today. I didn't get quite as far into the 1800s as I hoped because it's a very dense century where a lot of things happened. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it really was the century where the wool industry and I guess that commerce in Australia really started to take off.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess a few things you've raised that I think might be worth exploring further. So yeah, I just one connection I made, you mentioned that like anti-Bligh sentiment and how it was kind of, yeah, perpetuated in those movies and that kind of thing. And, yeah, the song we played, Bly by Rum Rebellion, you mentioned kind of sort of perpetuates that narrative of, like, Bly being, but perhaps, yeah, that narrative, as much as there might be elements of truth to it, sort of distract from other figures. Also, another connection I was wondering, something I've been looking into recently in my work has been around stolen wages from Indigenous people, and underpayment and those kind of issues. It might not have been something you've come across. You mentioned like low-paid convict labour, but yeah, do you know about any connections between like underpaid Indigenous labour as well, or in terms of the wool industry, or is it more convict labour in that case?
In the very, very early days of the colony, it was convict labour, and those people weren't paid at all because they were imprisoned, right? Mm-hmm. I think there definitely was some exploitation of Aboriginal labour. I think that probably starts to happen a bit more later.
Mm-hmm.
You do hear a few stories about Aboriginal people working at this point, but I think it takes off a bit more like as the Australian wool industry is expanding and they need a lot of workers to handle all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess I was also thinking about that. You mentioned like carceral capitalism. I was thinking like today and you know, this is probably going on everywhere, but we probably hear more from the US, but I'm thinking particularly in the US of that idea of like really low paid labor for big corporations and that kind of thing, paying their workers virtually nothing to do that today. So yeah, there's lots of sort of parallels with things going on today as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I haven't really researched this properly yet, but there's a lot of interesting labor stuff that starts to happen around the wool industry. So, you know, it's kind of hard to compare the 1810s to the 1890s. That's a really different time period in terms of like the technology and everything. But I know that there was a big shearers strike, I think, in 1891. And it's often got to do with, like, the price of wool fluctuating. So if the price of wool goes down, they start paying the workers less. Another thing I could kind of talk about, there's a lot of interesting things happens in the 19th century. You know the song Waltzing Matilda, a very famous Australian song, and it talks about squatters and swagmen.
Mm-hmm.
So what a squatter is in this time period is it's usually a wealthy landowner who is illegally grazing their animals on what they called crown land. So it means they haven't officially been granted the land, but they are profiting from it by grazing their animals on there. So that's why they were called squatters. And it was technically not legal, but they at the same time they were advancing the colony, so it was sort of tolerated. And these squatters ended up having like a huge amount of power in Australia for the entire 19th century, to the point where they actually called it the squatocracy. Mm. So like, you know, it comes from aristocracy. They had all this like economic and political influence and, you know, and it was still a lot of the same corruption, like they were controlling the courts and that kind of thing. So I almost feel like there's a line that can be drawn between the establishment of these kind of systems where these wealthy landowners kind of control everything. And it almost seems like it's still like that today in some ways.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it is interesting the power of the squatters, whereas like now when we think of squatters, we think of people who are kind of more like at the bottom of the sort of like the hierarchy in the society as well. Yeah, you're also in part one, and this is more contemporary, more than historical, but you mentioned the idea of Australian wool today being greenwashed, like it's ethical, it's environmental, it's natural is quite a big claim as well that's often made.
Yeah.
And I thought it might be worth, you did that a bit in part one as well, but yeah, do you want to touch on that at all, I guess from like a vegan perspective or some of those issues or some of the problems with those claims?
Yeah, well, I think when people say things like that, they're often pitting it against like plastic-based materials like polyester and stuff. But yeah, I really don't think that it's accurate to say that wool is sustainable, you know, when we consider all the land clearing that has to happen and just like how destructive sheep are to the land generally. And, you know, we've been talking about wool here, but I think it's also included in this is the sheepskin industry. So I think of things like Ugg boots, which are a very popular Australian product that gets sold internationally. And yeah, it's all part of this same problem. Actually, well, one interesting thing, this is about something else. A few months back, I actually did a trip to New South Wales and I was staying in the area that they call the MacArthur region, right? Mm. So mm-hmm. I was around all these places and I found that really fascinating because I'd already been reading about this history. And I was curious to visit Camden Park House, which was one of the MacArthur estates. There's also Elizabeth Farm in Parramatta, which was their original estate, I think. So I wanted to visit Camden Park House, but it's only open like once every 3 months because the MacArthur family still lives there. Like, oh, there's wow. still a thing.
Wow.
Which I found that's kind of crazy. So, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'll go there one day, but you have to plan it in advance, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything you want to touch on the last few minutes, or if not, we could go back to the Nup to the Cup to finish things off. But
yeah, I guess I'm not sure like when I'm going to do the next part of this series or how far I'll get. Mm-hmm. I think maybe I just want to mention a few things that are about to happen. So far, like what we've been talking about, Melbourne doesn't exist yet. I think Melbourne starts in the 1830s, and then it really explodes in the 1850s because of the gold rush. So I believe up until that time, wool is the main industry in Australia, and then it later becomes gold. Mm. So, you know, animal agriculture and mining, there are big things here, right?
And was gold like around 1830s? Is that
I
right?
I thought it was 1850s, but I haven't read about this yet.
No, that's totally off the top of my head, so that absolutely could be wrong. Yeah.
So I guess like stay tuned for when I get on to the next part.
Yep. We've also got coming up over the next couple of weeks, we'll be hearing more about the Animal Liberation Film Festival as well. So yeah, you can check that out on social media or online as well if you search Animal Liberation Film Festival. But I'm helping to organise that, but that's coming up in December. So keep your eye out for that and keep your ears out for a Freedom of Species show on that topic in more depth coming in the next couple of weeks as well. A reminder that you can check out the Nup to the Cup event. So nuptothecup.org is the website and events near you. You can find events all around Australia, so not just those listening in Melbourne as well. And yeah, I guess one thing with the Melbourne Cup, I think I've noticed, I'm not sure if you've noticed this too, but I feel like I, in addition to doing this show, I have a podcast which is not really, particularly since I've started doing this show, not really animal specific, more sort of like progressive left kind of issues. And I've noticed over the years of like that issue, just like my feed filling up with anti-Melbourne Cup stuff, not even like in the last year or two, but even going back a few years, like compared to like a few years before, where it was kind of like an animal rights campaigners were against it, obviously, but it was maybe less of an issue. But there was just such a big thing from like an audience or followers who are not like animal specific, more just kind of progressive people. So that's been, there seems to be a real turn in public sentiment against it. I think
when you consider that the gambling industry is literally one of the biggest industries in Australia, right up there with like what, mining and real estate, it's understandable. Like it's an easy event to like be against if you're progressive.
Absolutely, yeah. I did hear of the a call out from the Ambulance Victoria just to call out, make sure you only call 000 if it's an absolute emergency and all this kind of, if it's life threatening, etc. And I was like, but that's always the case. What's going on? They're saying the ambulances are overloaded, and one of the factors is the Melbourne Cup coming up.
Is that because people are drinking too much?
Yeah. Well, that was my guess. Why that would be related? Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's horse deaths, but they don't ambulances wouldn't be involved in that case, but that was my assumption. So yeah, there was like a particular call out that they've got a lot more ambulances ready to go, but as it is, they're going to be totally overwhelmed in the next few days. So yeah. Another angle, I guess.
Only occurred to me like a couple of days ago that, you know, Melbourne Cup was coming up, but I'd be curious to like read a bit more about the history of the Melbourne Cup and how it became such an established thing.
Absolutely.
I just did some really quick casual reading about it. And one thing I can say that like even in the 19th century, there were people that were opposing horse racing. Mm. And that was before it was really a thing in Australia, but like in England and stuff. There were people that were against it for animal cruelty reasons.
Wow,
I think it's just worth mentioning that like animal rights isn't even exclusively a modern issue. Mm. There have always been people that have cared about this on some level.
Absolutely, yeah. And I did, I'm trying to think if this was Melbourne Cup or something else, but was there, I'm not sure you followed this at all, but Taylor Swift was going to perform at something.
Oh, I do
was
remember that.
Was that Melbourne Cup or was it another?
It was several years ago.
Yeah.
And I think her fans like pressured her, don't do this.
She did, but then she cancelled and said it was a scheduling conflict. So mm-hmm. I thought it was very Taylor Swift in terms of like marketing.
That's what she does. She doesn't want to actually like take a stand
exactly.
on anything.
Rock the boat too much. Yeah. I'm like, oh, my fans are annoyed at me, so I'll cancel it. Yeah. But some of my fans probably like horse racing, so I won't say I'm taking a stand against horse racing. And yeah, I thought it was a very business-like way to address the issue. Yeah, very kind of corporate response, I guess. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. All right. I might announce the next song now.
Mm-hmm.
So this last one I'm going to play today comes from a Sydney-based musical duo of two Guri Ngai women called Charlie Needs Braces. It's a song about an important river that runs through the lands we've been talking about. So colonizers named this river the Hawkesbury, but the original name was the Darebin. So this song is Darebin by Charlie Needs Braces.
And just before we get to that, just a few final plugs as well. So first of all, Freedom of Species is part of the iRaw network, so podcasts about animals. So if you want to hear other shows dealing with animal rights issues, you can check it out at iRawPod.com. A reminder, our show is 1 to 2 every Sunday. We've played a lot of music, which is very much not just like, you know, passing the time between the discussion, but is really directly relevant to the topics that Betty has been discussing. So just a reminder, if you do want to check out the podcast or the show with the music, again, you can listen live 1 to 2 every Sunday via the 3CR website, 3cr.org.au from anywhere around the world, or if you've still got a radio, 855 AM if you're in Melbourne. Another way you can check out our shows with the full music is you can click on latest episode on our website, 3cr.org.au/freedom of species, and basically the full hour, like the music, everything is available there just for the week after it airs, so you can check out the music that way, because you won't be able to hear the music if you're listening via the podcast apps. If you have any feedback on this show, and perhaps Betty could address that in a part 3, for example, you can contact us at freedomofspecies@gmail.com is our email. We're also on a bunch of different social media platforms, including Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. So you can check us out there as well and give any feedback there as well. Stay tuned for Rotations, which is coming up, and Rotation features different hosts across 3CR, a bunch of us Freedom of Species presenters have done it before. You can stay tuned for that for music cover a wide range of different topics and themes from presenters all across the 3CR network. So stay tuned for that. So that is some more music coming up. And because I've gone on quite a bit at the end, Betty, maybe you could remind listeners of the song details again.
Last song is Darebin by Charlie Needs Braces.
Thanks for listening and thanks for putting together the show, Betty.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.